Illinois. Before that, he started at MIT and then went to graduate school to Berkeley, where we were actually classmates together, so it's a pleasure to have him here. He did postdoctoral work at University of Innsbruck and at Los Alamos, and he now holds the Bardeen Chair in the Physics Department at the University of Illinois. He's a fellow at the American Physical Society and the as well as the Optical Society. His research has appeared in a number of Physics Today type publications, and he's received a few Young Scientist type awards. So I think we're looking forward to a very interesting talk. So Paul Kwiat.
Thanks very much, and thanks very much for the invitation to come here. I'm afraid I'm no longer eligible for Young Scientist Awards. It's sad, but that's the way it goes, I guess. Okay, so I have a habit of never keeping the same title when I talk about things. Let's see if I can get one of these things, clickers, to work. Okay, so that's not the one to hit. So 101 is probably a little bit too optimistic for this talk. So instead, I'm only going to talk about four uses, and probably not actually of a Schrodinger cat, but something a little bit smaller than that. So we'll say maybe a kitten embryo or something like that. As long as we're on the animal theme, when I first came to Illinois, I thought we could use a better logo than our swoosh, so maybe a spherical cow. And this actually ties in to my next slide, where almost exactly 5 years ago, this English poet, Valerie Laws, got a grant of £2,000 using sheep to study quantum mechanics. She says, quantum mechanics is a branch of physics a lot of people find hard to understand, which is true, of course. Seems to go against common sense, also true. I decided to explore randomness and some principles of quantum mechanics through poetry using the medium of sheep. So she took these sheep and she painted words on them and she rang a bell or a gong or something like that and let them rearrange themselves and then wrote down whatever they said. So, okay, these are my own sheep in my group. We don't actually have a dress code. It just looks that way. So a number of graduate students, some of whom have finally started graduating, and it's always, they don't tell you that when you first become a professor, that you're actually going to have to let them go at the end. It's kind of a sad thing. So I actually recently became the head of our safety committee, and so in keeping with that, we practice safe principles at University of Illinois. I should say, though, there's something ironic about this photo, which is that we actually caused an accident. This is climbing up on this huge statue at the corner of campus, and a fellow was riding on a motorcycle watching us all there in our bow ties and such, and he crashed into the van in front of him. So there's some sort of conservation of safety going on there. Okay, so it's always dangerous to talk about too many topics, so I thought I'd start with negative numbers so I wouldn't have such a high number at the end. So I'll give just a brief overview of quantum information and talk about what I mean by entanglement and how we create entanglement in photons and use that to do various interesting things like testing non-locality. I'll give you an introduction into quantum cryptography and sort of a new topic, what I would call relativistic quantum cryptography. And then onto things, this might be entanglement 201 or 401, sort of called hyperentanglement, using the fact that particles can be entangled in multiple degrees of freedom at once. And then an application of that to quantum dense coding. And if at the end of that we actually have 2 minutes of time, a quick lesson in quantum cooking. So quantum information, as many of you may know, is a field that came up roughly in the last 20 years or so. And the idea is to use some of the very bizarre features of quantum mechanics to do things in information processing which would be difficult or impossible otherwise. And so we'll talk a little bit about quantum cryptography today. You can use non-local correlations between particles to distribute secret keys, which you can then use for encryption. Some of you might have heard about quantum teleportation, where you can have an unknown quantum state disappear here and reappear over here without ever sending it directly in the middle path. There's a lot of work around the world now trying to build a quantum computer, a device based on quantum bits or qubits. Such a computer would be, I don't want to say infinitely faster since I'm talking to scientists here, but would be much, much, much faster for solving certain types of problems. It'd be infinitely faster for solving an infinitesimally small number of problems. But some of them can be quite important. For example, solving quantum mechanics problems, simulating other quantum systems. Something that's not always associated with these is the idea of metrology, quantum metrology, the possibility of making measurements better than you could do in the classical limit, non-invasive measurements. And so there's sort of a whole area that's likely to be important, I think, for technology in the decades to come. And underlying all of these areas, there's obviously a lot of interesting fundamental physics. The typical sort of resource, or if I can say quantum magic, that goes into most of these is this phenomenon of entanglement. That's what happens when you have a quantum system and it becomes coupled to another quantum system, and they become entangled. If this is something you like to have happen, you might call it a measurement. And if it's something you don't like to have happen, you might call it decoherence. In any event, the goal is to gain control over ever larger and larger systems, basically to try and understand this transition from the quantum world that we believe in to the classical world that, of course, we also believe in because we live in it, trying to understand that transition. So the key of quantum information can be understood by contrasting it with classical information. Classical information, at its base, we can represent by binary digits or bits, so things that can be 0 or 1. One of the key features is, of course, that bits are copyable. Classical information is copyable. We rely on that all the time. You're relying on it at the moment because you can all see the same thing on the screen, so you're all making a copy of that. So in quantum information, we have quantum bits, which are also known as qubits. So we can have those in states, say, 0 or 1. But as you know, we can also make arbitrary superpositions of those different states. And one of the key features of quantum information is that it is not possible to make a copy of quantum information, unknown quantum information. So-called unclonable or no-cloning theorem applies. And if someone wants to ask afterward, there's a very simple proof of that. So to realize qubits, basically any two-level system will do formally. So we could use the, say, ground and excited state of some atom, or spin up and spin down states of some spin a half particle. I'll be talking quite a bit about polarization today. So we can use the polarization of a single photon. And if it's horizontal, we call it a 0. If it's vertical, we call it a 1. And although all of these are formally equivalent, some of them are going to be more useful for certain applications than others. Certainly, if you want to do quantum communication, then photons, light is the way to go because, of course, it travels. And we already have a large infrastructure built around that. It's not so useful to be sending. I'm not going to say it's impossible to send hardware for communication. We do that certainly when we send letters through the mail, if we ever do that anymore. But for the most part, it's certainly easier to deal with photons for quantum communication. For storage, it's not so easy to store light, although I'll talk a little bit about an example we have of that. So there, people are looking more towards storing information in atomic systems or in spins. And if you want to do a scalable circuitry, it's possible we might be able to do that with photons or with atoms or spins. There's also a lot of work being done with solid-state systems, largely because, of course, we have a lot of experience using solid-state systems for scalable quantum for scalable circuitry. And the quantum phenomena that we're going to use in quantum information ranges everywhere from things which are very classical, like superposition and interference, all the way up to this most quantum mechanical of all features or all phenomena, that of entanglement. Okay, so just over, it's always good to have Einstein on one of your slides. It gives you some credibility, I guess. Just over 100 years ago, Einstein proposed that light was particles and used that to explain the photoelectric effect, and he got the Nobel Prize for that. It's somewhat ironic, not everyone knows this, but in fact, the photoelectric effect doesn't prove that light is quantized. You can have a semi-classical description of that, where you have a classical field and a quantum mechanical atom. So the question is, how would you prove that light is quantized? Well, here's one thing that you can do. You can take a beam splitter and send what you think is, say, a single photon onto this beam splitter and put two detectors in either of those ports. And as we know, you'll only detect the photon in one of the two outputs. And moreover, it is completely likely, if this is a 50-50 beam splitter, completely likely that the photon will be transmitted or reflected. There's no way that you can predict which of those is going to happen. And it was this sort of an argument that, or this sort of a phenomenon that led Einstein to his fairly famous comment, God does not play dice. I should say, already we now have, this is our first example of a useful device, if you want to call it that, for quantum information. In particular, This is a perfectly good quantum random number generator. So if you label this detector a 0 and this detector a 1, then you send single photons in, you see which detector fires, and you get a string of random numbers, zeros and ones, that is governed purely by the quantum mechanics of what the photon does at the beam splitter. And you can now buy these. There are a couple companies that sell random number generators like this. So I want to ratchet this up a little bit into things that more in the, well, to a slightly larger system. So this is meant to be a depiction of Schrodinger's cat experiment, although killing the cat is, of course, no longer allowed by animal rights protection agencies. So instead, this cat is hooked up to a carnival ride sort of bullseye. And what happens when the photon hits the What happens when the photon hits the bullseye is it puts the cat into a tub of water, and you know that's fate worse than death for a cat. Okay, so now we have a beam splitter here, and so now of course we get a superposition of either the photon being reflected, in which case we have a dry happy cat, or the photon being transmitted and hitting the activator here, and then we have a wet unhappy cat. So we get this entanglement. Or at least this is what traditional quantum mechanics would say, an entanglement between these two systems. Now, of course, that entangled state is not going to stay that way for very long. Some people might argue that it doesn't stay that way for any length of time, that you can't make such large objects in quantum superpositions. I don't really want to go into that philosophical argument at the moment. So we can't make really entangled states of anything even as big as this, even as big as a DNA molecule, but we can make entangled photons. So just so that we're all on the same page, and it's always nice to hear things that you already know about, let me just define what I mean by entanglement. So we can, if I have two quantum systems, in this case I'll talk about polarized photons, there are two types of states I can write for them. I can either have states which are factorizable, in which case I can write the total quantum mechanical state as the state of one system times the state of the other. So for example, the state HH here, or both these photons are horizontally polarized. The state HH plus HV, that initially might not look like it's a product, but you realize you can factor out the fact that the first photon is horizontally polarized. The second photon is then in the state H plus V, and that's just a diagonally or a plus 45 degree polarized photon. So again, I have a product state of the two photons. In this case, each of the particles has its own definite properties. Okay, in contrast, if I have a non-factorizable state, one where I cannot write the overall quantum state as a simple product, that's this phenomenon known as entanglement. And what I've written here are the four sort of canonical Bell states after John Bell in both the horizontal vertical basis and the diagonal basis. These four states span the whole basis, the whole Hilbert space that describes the photons, or the polarization states of the photons. And let's just look at two in particular, or maybe I'll just focus on this one, the state HH plus VV. If I write this in the diagonal basis, or in fact in any linear polarization basis, the two photons always have the same polarization, and yet each photon individually is completely unpolarized. So if I ask, what's the polarization of photon number one, it doesn't have a definite polarization. I put it through a polarizer of any orientation, and the photon will always have a 50% chance of being absorbed and a 50% chance of being transmitted. But as soon as that happens, as soon as I detect photon number one and say, find out that it's horizontally polarized, I automatically know that photon two is also horizontally polarized. Or if I detect photon one to be polarized at minus 45 degrees, then I know that photon two is polarized at minus 45 degrees. So in an entangled state, neither particle has definite properties alone. All the information is in the joint properties of this two-particle system. And that's true even if these two particles are very far apart. And so in that sense, we have non-local correlations in quantum mechanics. So Schrodinger described entanglement as the quintessential feature of quantum mechanics, basically the one that entirely distinguishes it from classical physics. So entangled states, as I've already indicated, are important for many different aspects of physics. For one thing, that there are current understanding of how we have quantum measurements and how we have decoherence. They're key to demonstrations of quantum non-locality, as I'll talk a little bit more about. We can use those correlations for quantum cryptography. I'll talk also about quantum dense coding and quantum teleportation, where you can use entanglement to enable the distribution of a quantum state from one location to another without actually sending it directly. And inside a quantum computer, the intermediate states are all very complex entangled states. Okay, so there's definitely an interest in looking at entanglement. John Bell, although he was a theorist, had a very practical point of view, though, which is how do you actually make entangled states? Now, I should say entangled states are being made constantly everywhere all around us all the time because all our quantum systems are interacting with each other all the time. But what we'd like to be able to do is make them in a controlled way, in a way that we can then use for various applications. So in particular, I'm going to describe how we can make entangled photons. And that's through the process of spontaneous parametric down conversion, a complicated name for a fairly simple process. I have a nonlinear crystal, and I send in a high-energy photon. And sometimes that high-energy photon will split into two low-energy photons, two daughter photons. We have to satisfy energy conservation, and we have to satisfy momentum conservation. And in fact, those two conservation laws already lead to entanglement in the energy and entanglement in the momentum. And I'll actually come back to this momentum conservation a little bit later in the talk. Okay. Let me just say another word about this process before I move on. This splitting process is not very likely. It's only about 10 to the minus 10 probability of that happening. And that might seem ridiculously small, but let me remind you that this laser pointer probably has 10 to the 16 photons per second coming out of it. So you can take a 10 to the minus 10 hit and still get an appreciable number of pairs being produced. The second thing I'd like to point out is that this process is not, or this type of crystal is not particularly exotic or unique. In particular, there's one of them inside this laser pointer. Turns out you can't make a green laser diode, or at least no one ever has, for reasons I won't claim to understand. But obviously you're seeing a green laser pointer here. So what's inside this laser pointer is an infrared laser. It's a neodymium YAG laser running at 1064 nanometers. And this process and a nonlinear crystal, which is running this process in reverse, we're taking the two infrared photons and combining them into one green photon. So the point is that the crystals that we use for this are not particularly hard to come by. OK, so I've talked about the fact that we have entanglement in energy and momentum. What I'd really like to produce, though, is polarization entanglement. And to understand how that works, let me just say a little bit more about these crystals. It turns out they're birefringent, so different polarizations go through at different speeds. And it happens that if you pump with an extraordinarily polarized photon, where that's defined by the crystal optic axis, then the two daughter photons are emitted on opposite sides of a cone. And they're emitted, they're both ordinarily polarized. So they both have a definite polarization. So how does that enable us to produce entanglement? So here's the same crystal. I'm pumping it with a vertically polarized pump. I'm producing horizontally polarized pairs of photons. They are not polarization entangled because they both are just horizontally polarized. So they both have a definite polarization. If you were to rotate everything in the system about the z-axis, about the optic axis here, so you rotate the pump polarization to horizontal, rotate this crystal by 90 degrees, then, of course, the process will still happen. And in this case, we'll produce a cone of vertically polarized pairs of photons. And the key for getting polarization entanglement now is I take two of these crystals, I put them back to back, and I pump them, say, with 45-degree polarized light. And now there is quantum mechanical uncertainty as to where the birth process takes place. So there's an amplitude for the conversion having taken place in the first crystal, giving me the H horizontal-horizontal term, and an amplitude for it taking place in the second crystal, giving me the vertical-vertical term. And as long as these two processes are indistinguishable, then I get this entangled state, this maximally entangled state. Great. So the question was, it seems like I must be crazy because clearly you can tell whether you're on the outside cone or the inside cone, and therefore they're distinguishable. Absolutely. So in practice, the opening angle of these cones is first relatively small, only a few degrees. Second of all, the thickness of the crystals is maybe a half a millimeter compared to a 2 millimeter diameter of the pump. And so that means that the cones are actually kind of blurry, if you will. And So, but this is a good question. Will they or won't they be indistinguishable? And the way to actually test that is to test it and see have you made an entangled state. But certainly before you do the experiment, there's no reason to presume offhand that it's going to work and that you will get an entangled state this way. But you'll see in a minute that, in fact, it does work. So it is possible to make them indistinguishable. OK, a couple comments on this that we'll need for later purposes. One, if we simply tune the pump polarization, we can control the relative weightings of these two terms. So if I only have vertical polarization coming in, I'll only make the HH term. So therefore, and if I have something that's close to vertical but not quite, I'll have the HH with a little bit of VV. So I can tune these states. I can make so-called non-maximally entangled states. The other thing is that there's this relative phase between these two terms, which we can also adjust. And in fact, recently we found out a way to compensate. If you just sort of go and you buy the two crystals and you set the whole thing up, you'll find that this phase phi changes depending on where you are around the cone because of these birefringent crystals. But it turns out you can put in another crystal that basically subtracts that effect so that all the pairs have the same value of phi. So that's important for having a nice, pure, maximally entangled state. So how do you know that you've made such a state? How do you know that you've been successful in that? Well, one thing is you see that whenever I make a horizontal, the other one's horizontal. And whenever I make a vertical, the other one's vertical. OK, we do that test, and that turns out to be true. But that doesn't prove that the two processes are indistinguishable. We could have this problem where they're not indistinguishable, in which case it would still be, I would still only produce HHs and VVs. So in order to prove that I have this entangled state, HH, say HH plus VV, I want to look at this in another basis. In particular, I want to look at this in a diagonal basis. And remember that if I, the state HH plus VV in the diagonal basis looks like 45, 45 plus minus 45, minus 45. So what I'm showing here is data when we analyze photon number one through a polarizer at 45 degrees. And then I vary the angle of a polarizer looking at photon number two. And we see that, in fact, OK, from this state, if photon number 1 is 45-degree polarized, then photon number 2 should also be 45-degree polarized, certainly not minus 45. And we see that, in fact, we get the sort of expected Malice's law behavior for these fringes. And they have obviously extremely high contrast within error of a perfect quantum mechanical state. OK, and we have a nice ultra-bright source. One can now ask, well, what can one do with such a thing? Well, one of the applications I mentioned of entanglement was looking at non-locality, tests of non-locality. And back in 1935, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen said, well, maybe the correlations that we see in quantum mechanical effects are really due to some local element of reality. They didn't use the term local hidden variable model, but that's basically what they were implying, that there's some extra information, although we don't know what polarization the photons have. Somehow the photons know what real polarization they have. And in 1965, John Bell showed that, in fact, quantum mechanics gives different statistical predictions than any local realistic model. And those are governed by the so-called Bell inequality. The Bell inequality, I'm not going to go into details over it except to say that it's a combination of coincidence rates measured in different bases. And you combine them in a particular way, and you can show that for any local hidden variable model, this combination of these rates should be bounded by 2. And with our source, we're able to get, basically in a matter of seconds or minutes, thousands of standard deviation violations of this. So much, obviously, 2.7 is bigger than 2. You might say, well, what does quantum mechanics actually predict for this? Quantum mechanics predicts a maximum value of 2 times square root of 2, which is 2.83. And in a version of this where we really tried to see how close can we get to the quantum mechanical maximum, we're able to get really quite close to the quantum mechanical maximum. One of the reasons this is interesting, not that it's particularly interesting to get 2,000 sigma or something like that, because this is calculated purely on the basis of statistical uncertainty. Certainly, there are systematics in our experiment that would make that be much more significant than that. But it's interesting looking at this higher limit. Why? Because people have suggested that you could have theories which were more quantum mechanical, which were more non-local than quantum mechanics. So in particular, this value of S it turns out, can go all the way up to 4. That's the maximum value that you can actually logically achieve for S. And yet quantum mechanics maxes out at 2√2. So there are theories which are more non-local than quantum mechanics, which would say predict a value of 3 or 3.5. I think the only way to test whether or not reality actually maybe has some small component of that is to actually see, well, okay, how close can we get to this 2√2? Or is there a possibility that it's over a little bit? At the moment, it certainly doesn't seem to be that way. Okay. So over the past couple decades, there's been sort of a Moore's Law improvement in these sort of sources. So way back in the, basically 20 years ago, we were looking at rates of roughly 1 parsec, and a few years ago, we were able to get something like 2,000,000 pairs a second, very high fidelity polarization in tangled states. Currently, this number, this 2,000,000, is in fact limited by detector saturation. Our detectors can only fire a couple million times a second, and we're working on improving that. So what are these actually good for other than tests of non-locality? So as the first application, I want to discuss quantum cryptography. This is my break slide. So there are two things I like about this cartoon. First of all, it's always good when your field makes it into Dilbert, because then some of your funding agents actually learn about it. And the second thing is there's a little asterisk here, application of John S. Bell's theorem, and the asterisk says, really no kidding. So I thought that's kind of funny. It's not exactly correct that when you change the spin of one electron, the other one changes. That would allow you to send signals faster than light. So it's not, nature is not quite that nice. Okay, so in order to understand how quantum cryptography works, we need to understand a little bit about classical cryptography. And there are two types of classical encryption. One of them is so-called public key encryption, which is what you're most used to when you're encrypting things on the internet. That's based on the fact that certain mathematical problems are probably hard, like factoring numbers is probably a hard problem. Although, if you have a quantum computer, which no one does, but anyway, aside from that little detail, quantum computers actually can factor efficiently. And so I don't want to talk about public key encryption. I instead want to talk about private key or secret key encryption. And this is how that works. We have two players, Alice and Bob, and they share a key. See, Alice has a key. And the key is just a random string of zeros and ones that both of them know. So in order to send a message to Bob, Alice is going to take her message, which is also a string of zeros and ones, and she's going to add it bit by bit to the key modulo 2. So she'll add the first bit of the message to the first bit of the key, and then the second bit of the message to the second bit of the key. 0 plus 0 is 0, 0 plus 1 is 1, and 1 plus 1 is 0 again because we're adding modulo 2. So after she does that, she has this ciphertext, which she then sends to Bob over some public channel. So she broadcasts it on the radio, or she puts it in the newspaper. And then Bob, because he has the same key, can simply repeat the process, and he'll come up with the same original message. Okay. This is a secure method of encryption. This is the only provably secure method of encryption. That's a very strong statement, but as far as I know, it's true. I'm wondering if I knew that it weren't true, whether I'd be allowed to tell you. In any event, as far as I know, it's true. This is the only provably secure method of encryption, but based on two assumptions. One assumption is that Alice and Bob are never allowed to reuse the key. If they ever use the key again, then you can get information. An eavesdropper could get information, could back out what the key was. The second assumption is that no one else has the key. Why is that? Well, because if an eavesdropper had the key or part of the key, then she could listen to the classical transmission of the ciphertext, and she could do exactly the same thing that Bob does, and in that way she could recover the message. So the problem then becomes, if you're Alice and Bob trying to do secret key cryptography, how do you get the key from Alice to Bob? Or how do they share a key? Because they can never reuse it. So, okay, they can start out together with some key, but eventually they use it up, and then how do you generate a key? And what's currently done at the moment is you have a courier For example, carrying the key in a briefcase or something like that, or you have a phone line that you hope is secure, or you have a fiber optic cable that you hope is secure, sending the key from Alice to Bob. The problem with that is that in all of those cases, the information is being carried classically. And classical information can be copied. And it's possible to copy classical information without leaving any trace that you've done that. So for example, if I have an electrical pulse going down a wire, that electrical pulse will induce a magnetic field in a little magnetic field sensor. And you can detect that magnetic field without disturbing that electrical pulse, so you can, an eavesdropper can detect that the pulse is there. Or as a maybe a better example, if I have an optical pulse that has a million photons in it, well, it's really a million plus or minus 1,000 because there's Poisson statistics. So an eavesdropper could strip off 10 of those photons, have definite knowledge that a pulse went by, and yet you'd have no way of detecting at the other end that there had been an eavesdropper. So quantum cryptography is going to solve this problem by using single photons to send the key from Alice to Bob. There are protocols that use single photons. I'm actually going to describe a photon that uses entangled photons. Why? Because we have an entangled photon source. That's one reason. And so if you have a hammer, it's good to find nails for it, I guess. The other thing is that there are some advantages of using entangled photons for cryptography. OK, so the protocol is really very simple. Alice and Bob start out with an entangled photon source. It's producing photons in my favorite entangled state. Everyone should have a favorite entangled state. Mine is the state HH plus VV, which in the diagonal basis, to remind you, is 45, 45, plus minus 45, minus 45. And one photon goes to Alice and one photon goes to Bob. And each of them can measure the polarizations of that photon in one of two ways. They can either ask, is the photon polarized horizontally or vertically? Or by firing this Pockel cell, they can ask whether it's the photon is polarized at 45 or minus 45 degrees. OK, so here's the simple protocol for cryptography. They're randomly going to measure each photon that they receive in either the horizontal, vertical, or the diagonal basis. They will discuss over a public channel which bases they used, but not the actual results. So they'll talk on the phone, and Alice will say, OK, for the first photon that I saw, I used the horizontal vertical basis. And Bob will say, I didn't see a first photon. My detectors weren't on yet. And so Alice will say, OK, well, for the second photon, I used the horizontal vertical basis too. And Bob will say, OK, I used the diagonal basis for that one. And so they just throw away the results in that case. Because the results, if they use different bases, in general, are going to be uncorrelated. However, in cases where they use the same basis, they keep their results. Why? Because then they should have perfectly correlated results. Whenever Alice saw horizontal, Bob saw horizontal. Whenever Alice saw minus 45, Bob saw minus 45. Now, we're almost done. They just agree to define, for example, horizontal and 45 as a 0, vertical and minus 45 as a 1, and now they have a secret key. OK. Pardon? The reason it's not a good question, the question is, why can't we just always use the horizontal vertical basis? That would be fine if all they were trying to do was communicate a 0 and 1. But there's one more step. The main reason that we're worried about this was we're worried about an eavesdropper. So if they're always going to use the horizontal vertical basis, then an eavesdropper could just sit there in the middle, measuring the horizontal vertical basis. And depending on what she saw, she sends a photon onto Bob with the correct polarization. The reason that this is secure against an eavesdropper is that she doesn't know which basis she should be making her measurement in. If she makes her measurement in the wrong basis, then she will introduce errors. And from those errors, Alice and Bob can then think that there's an eavesdropper. Yes? Oh, how do you know that horizontal means the same for the two observers? That's a very good question. In general, if the two observers are twirling with respect to each other or something, you'd have to send some classical signals to do alignment of the two systems. So that would be something that you would have to do. You'd have to have an alignment of the reference frames.
Where's the clock? How do I know when there's a photon and when there's not a photon?
Good. So the photons, the question is, where's the clock? The photons could be produced by a pulse source. In our experiment, we're actually using a CW source. And so they come out at random times. And Alice and Bob are going to basically write down when they got the photon, and then they talk over a public channel, and they make sure they're only looking at coincident events. Yes?
What
Great question. So the question is, what if there are a couple eavesdroppers and they're each measuring in different bases, or one eavesdropper who tries to split and measure in different bases? You can show that no matter what the eavesdropper does, if she gets any information at all, she will always introduce a disturbance. There's a trade-off. The more information she gets, the more of a disturbance she introduces. And so if she gets full information about a given photon, she completely disturbs its quantum state in some basis. So there always has to be a disturbance in some basis. OK. So if there is an error, in practice, there are always some errors. And you always assume that those are due to an eavesdropper. And so a typical way that you characterize these systems is with the bit error rate. It's a misnomer. It's not really a rate, but people always use that anyway. It's basically the percentage of errors. And
what's an error?
An error is when Alice thinks they have a 0 and Bob thinks they have a 1. And in order to find those, Alice and Bob will sacrifice some subset of their data to check to see what kind of errors they have. And there are ways also. So one way that they can do that is they can just say, okay, Alice say, okay, my first bit was a 0, my second one was a 1, my third one was a 0. Okay, and Bob can say yes, okay, no, yes. That's obviously, that lets them check their system, but then they don't have any key because they've just announced that over some public channel where they've been conversing with each other. So instead, they have to use slightly more sophisticated schemes. For example, they might say, the parity of my first 10 bits was a 0. And Bob says, yes, the parity of my first 10 bits was a 0. And unless they have an even number of errors, then they have some confidence that they don't have any errors in that. They've announced one bit of information, so then they have to throw away one of their bits when they do that. OK, so Alice and Bob, as part of their protocol, at the end of the day, they have to check to see what kind of errors they have. And if there are errors, they assume that they're due to an eavesdropper. As long as the errors are not using just basic quantum mechanics, you can calculate how much information an eavesdropper could have on the system depending on what the error rate is. And as long as that information is not too high, there are some other classical techniques that Alice and Bob can do, communication techniques, where they reduce the total amount of information, the total amount of key that they have, but they reduce the amount of information that the eavesdropper has by a much higher fraction. So they throw away some of their key and at the same time reduce a lot the information an eavesdropper has. The bottom result of that is that as you get higher error rates, the efficiency drops a lot. And in particular, if you have an error rate that's more than, say, about 11%, by the time you find those errors and you throw away enough data to make sure the eavesdropper doesn't know anything, you've thrown everything away and you don't have any more keys. So the efficiency goes to 0. Even if you don't have any errors, the efficiency in the scheme that I've described so far is only 50%. Why 50%? Because they only keep the data when they both measure in the same basis. There's another version of this called that uses six states. So in addition to using horizontal and vertical plus and minus 45 degrees, Alice and Bob also use left and right circular polarization. The reason they want to do that is that the eavesdropper then introduces higher errors, so she's easier to detect. But you see, in this case, when I put these on the same plot, in this case, you actually don't do as well, because there, if there are three bases, there's the horizontal, vertical, the diagonal, and left, right, Bob only measures in the same basis as Alice 1/3 of the time. So you're actually better off, you're more efficient to use this four-state scheme, which was originated by Bennett and Broussard in 1984, so it's called the BB84 scheme, than the six-state protocol. Now, if you could get away from the sifting stage. The sifting stage is where Alice and Bob talk to each other and they identify the cases where they use the same basis. If you didn't have to do that sifting, then you'd be able to, in principle, get an efficiency all the way up to 1, and then you'd always be better off using this six-state protocol than using this four-state protocol. So the question is, how can we eliminate the sifting? And that comes to this sort of a new scheme. It's conceptually very easy to understand what's going to happen. So I'm describing this, that Alice is sending a photon to Bob, and I'll start the movie in just a second. She's sending a photon to Bob, and depending on which basis It is. Whether it's in the diagonal basis or in the horizontal vertical basis, she will send him a classical signal. She will send him a classical signal telling him how he should measure it. So he's going to store that photon, and she'll wait until it's inside his house, and then she sends him a classical signal that informs him how he should measure that particular photon. So the first one is in the diagonal basis. This is in the horizontal vertical basis. Alice sends that information to Bob. He measures in the horizontal vertical basis. So you can see what happens, which is that in this case, the efficiency goes up to 100% because every photon that Bob gets from Alice can be used for cryptography. This is going to have the same security as the normal protocol that we already described. If you imagine that there's an eavesdropper in the middle and she has some quantum computer that she's entangled the photons to, in the normal protocol, Alice and Bob were going to exchange basis information, but they would have exchanged that basis information right after Bob made the measurement. Now they're still going to exchange basis information. They're just going to exchange it right before Bob makes the measurement. But from the perspective of an eavesdropper in the middle, if she's got some quantum state that's entangled, that she entangled to Bob's photon, the state of her system can't depend on whether or not Bob just made or is just about to make a measurement. If he could instantaneously, by making a measurement or not making a measurement, change the state of an eavesdropper's quantum system in a way that she could actually detect, well, then you could send signals faster than light, and that would be far too useful. So that doesn't actually work. So this has the same sort of security as the normal quantum cryptography. We assume that she can understand the entire classical signal. That's fine. She has complete access to it. Great. Good question. And let me answer that, and then I'll come back to this. So there's one more constraint for this to be secure. The thing that prevents her from doing the same thing that Bob does, and this is why we call this relativistic, is we need to make sure that the eavesdropper can't have the quantum signal and the classical signal at the same time. And the way that we do that is we make sure that the backward light cone of when Bob gets the quantum signal, so here's the backward light cone of when Bob gets the quantum signal, here's Alice sending the quantum signal to Bob, and here's Alice sending the classical signal to Bob, as long as the backward light cone of when Bob gets the quantum signal and the forward light cone of when Alice sends the classical signal, as long as those two light cones don't overlap, then there's no frame of reference where an eavesdropper can have both the classical and the quantum signal at the same time. And therefore, unless she has both the quantum and the classical signal, all she can do is make a random guess as to how to make the measurement, and then she'll introduce errors just as before. Is that your question also?
No, but it resolves it. My question was, why do you have an eavesdropper who's in motion relative to the other two? Doesn't that pull you simultaneity on you? But I think this answers that.
Right. It does answer it. So the price you have to pay for this gain in efficiency is that Alice and Bob, they do have to know their space-time coordinates, or at least they have to know, obviously, their relative space-time coordinates. So that's an extra thing you normally don't have to put into your system. Here you do. In practice, usually that's true, though, because people are synchronized by GPS clocks. But you have to make an assumption that the eavesdropper can't change all the GPS information coming into your laboratory. So you might think that's a very reasonable assumption, but nevertheless, it's an extra assumption that needs to be stated. Okay, so in order to implement this kind of cryptography protocol, one of the things that one needs is a fast modulation system, which I'm not going to talk about. The other way is we need to be able to store this photon for a while. And there are a number of different approaches that people are looking at now for storing quantum information, transferring it from photons into atoms and such. I'm going to stick with the simplest scheme, which is ours at the moment, which is the only one that's actually working very well. And that's simply that I have two mirrors. In this case, they're cylindrical mirrors. There's a hole in one of them. The photon comes in through the hole. It bounces back and forth, say, 100 times. It misses the hole the first 99 times and then goes out on the 100th time. And we've been able to achieve delays up to about 8 microseconds with this system. Unfortunately, the reflectivity of the mirrors is not as high as we would like it. At the moment, it's only about 99.8%. And in our present experiment with 180 nanosecond delay that corresponds to an 85% transmission. However, this is crude technology. It's people now routinely have mirrors that actually have five nines, so 99, even four nines, 99.99 would give a transmission of about 99%. Okay, one thing I like about these mirrors is they give nice pictures. So this is looking at an end view of the cavity. The photons are actually coming in through a tiny hole right there, and they're bouncing back and forth. Now, it's hard to see with the lights on, so if we turn the lights off, you can see a little bit better. And at the moment, we're focusing on this mirror, but we could instead focus on the nearby mirror. And what we're looking at now is the light which is coming through the mirror. Why is there any light coming through the mirror? Because this was this laser, this alignment laser, is a different wavelength than the mirrors are coded for. So a lot more of the light is transmitted. Still not very much, but okay, so we can store light in the system. How can we then use that? So here's our system for using entangled photons for this relativistic quantum cryptography. We use an ultraviolet pump beam from an argon ion laser. We go through this two-crystal sandwich. We actually produce photons, one of which is at 670 nanometers, the other one's at 737 nanometers. That satisfies energy conservation. So the long wavelength one goes to Alice. And what does she do? Well, she randomly measures in either the horizontal vertical basis. So she just has a couple beam splitters here, and then can randomly measure in the horizontal vertical basis, in the diagonal basis, or in the circular polarization basis. Meanwhile, the other photon is sent over to Bob and stored in his cavity. When she gets information, when Alice gets information of which basis she's made her measurement in, she sends that to Bob. He uses that to measure in the same basis. Okay, so these are the curves that I showed before of what you can do if you're not using this relativistic scheme, along with a couple data points that we get just by basically blocking the signal going from Alice to Bob, the classical signal. These are the theoretical curves that one would expect for this relativistic scheme. This is our data in this case. Now, the data is not quite up to the theoretical curve because we have these 15% cavity losses. But nevertheless, we're able to achieve better than a 50% efficiency. This is this so-called relativistic advantage. This efficiency is for a given detected photon, whether or not it goes into the key. So our efficiency could be 1%. Correct. So our efficiency could be very low. In practice, our detector efficiencies are maybe 50%, but we're also going through single mode fiber, and so the actual net efficiency is maybe 3% or something like that. Well, okay, it depends which way you're worried about mucking. So one thing you might be worried about is mucking with the polarization. Great. So the thing is that I can send this, this is linearly polarized at the moment, and I can send this out to the moon, and it'll still be linearly polarized because the atmosphere ain't birefringent. It would be if you were dealing with radio waves, and then you'd have that as an effect. So as long as you can avoid that, it's OK. There's another problem that you might miss because you have turbulence in the air. And people move. So there you have to do tracking. But it's the same sort of tracking that people currently do at the moment for satellite, for tracking a satellite, for example, or astronomy. When you're looking at a star, you're looking through the atmosphere, and you're able to track that. But you'll lose some because of turbulence. That's OK. Losing doesn't really hurt you because lost. I should be careful. Losing doesn't hurt the security. On the other hand, you might not get any photons through, and your detectors in general have noise. So at some point, the signal to noise will get low enough that you can't send signals anymore.
And you have this other communication channel, which has to be there in network 2 in.
That's true. But you can use that as, for example, you could send that along the same optical path, just with a different wavelength. Great.
So there must be some killer reason for this that I'm not understanding. Can you repeat the question, please?
Yes, yes. The question, which is more of a comment, which is that, well, it seems like you've gone to an awful lot of trouble to gain, at best, a factor of 1.7 or 2.5 or something like that. It seems like that was a lot of trouble to go through to get that. Would this really be economical? Would you really want to do this in a real quantum cryptography, in a real quantum cryptography system? Which, by the way, you can buy real quantum cryptography systems now, too. Not with entangled photons yet, but that's coming. The answer is no, you wouldn't want to. It is too much of a pain. It turned out to be quite a bit more painful than we thought, actually, setting the whole thing up. Two comments. One, part of the pain is setting up this cavity is not so nice. If you're already working in optical fibers because you're doing cryptography over optical fibers, then you can just put in a long extra loop of fiber, and that's no pain whatsoever. So it's immediate and it's free. I think the main interest in this, or the main reason it's interesting, is, as far as I know, it's the first protocol that does better than normal quantum information by introducing another aspect of modern physics, in this case by introducing this relativistic effect. So it's not so much the issue that this is a fabulous thing for quantum cryptography as that it highlights that by looking at other features, you might be able to gain other benefits. Other questions? So. The photons are not necessarily entangled only in polarization. In fact, I've already talked about the fact that they can be entangled in energy and in momentum, orbital angular momentum. So there's other entanglements that the photons can have. And one of the interesting things to look at is photons that are simultaneously entangled in multiple degrees of freedom. We call that hyperentangled. So you can have a photon which is entangled in polarization and in its various spatial modes and in energy. Why would you be interested in that? Well, for one thing, you get a larger Hilbert space to play around in. A second thing is that it's fairly easy to perform quantum logic between different degrees of freedom of the same photon. What do I mean by quantum logic? You might have something where you want one quantum bit to affect another quantum bit. That's a common thing that you would want in a quantum computer. If you have two separate photons, it's hard to have one photon affect another photon, unless they are mediated by axions, which is a very low coupling constant. So instead, if you have 2 degrees of freedom on the same photon representing 2 qubits, that's fairly easy to get an interaction. So for example, if you want the color of the energy of the photon to affect the momentum of the photon, you go through a prism. Or if you want the polarization to affect the momentum, you go through a polarizing beam splitter. So the point is there are very simple optical elements to give very clean logic operations between different degrees of freedom on the same photon. And in fact, those allow you then to do some new capabilities in quantum information processing in terms of remotely preparing different states, being able to distinguish all the different Bell states and this so-called super-duper dense coding, which is what I will... it's true if you write these just in terms of K, then you will also have energy built into them. But I'm talking more about the spatial distribution, which doesn't necessarily have K. You could imagine dividing out what the magnitude of the K vector was. And in terms of the polarization, that's completely different. You can have, for example, a Gaussian beam that's coming out of this laser, and it can have any polarization whatsoever. Or you could have a different... Well, you could certainly have a Gaussian beam pointing here or a Gaussian beam pointing there, and the polarization is an independent degree of freedom of that. Yes, so that's why I could have written this entirely as an integral in K, and then it would have been a three-dimensional integral instead. So I've broken them up, in some sense artificially, but that's when we do the experiment, it's sort of easier to break them up that way with apparatus that we have. A delta function to the extent that the pump is monochromatic, yes.
Well, for any photon, e squared minus p squared is zero. For each and every photon, it has zero mass. That's delta function.
Yes, right. True. Right. OK, so we can make these hyperentangled photons using, again, this sort of two-crystal scheme. and you need some special lenses to be able to access these different spatial modes. In particular, we can use spatial modes like this, different Hermite-Gaussian modes. So this could represent, this little H here represents this Hermite-Gaussian mode. The little V represents this Hermite-Gaussian mode. These add, in some ways, very much like polarizations, in that if you take H plus V, then you'll get a diagonal stripe, diagonal spatial mode. And so you can imagine having the different Bell states both in polarization and in spatial mode. And this is just to show that we can make various kinds of states. What I'm plotting here are the density matrices that we've measured and reconstructed, I should say, of the states. This is the total density matrix in the polarization and spatial mode bases. And this is if I trace over the spatial mode basis, this is what the polarization density matrix looks like. And if I trace over polarization, this is what the spatial mode looks like. Basically, this is a state where in both degrees of freedom, I'm maximally entangled. This is a state where I'm maximally entangled in the spatial degree of freedom, but I'm, in some sense, half mixed in the polarization. So I have an equal combination of horizontal, horizontal, and vertical, vertical, but there's no coherence between those two. There's no off-diagonal elements of the density matrix. And then on this side, I have a state which is, again, completely entangled in spatial mode, but completely mixed in polarization. So the photons here are completely unpolarized. So this is just to show that we have control over these, that we can explore these different regions. Okay, so superdense coding. This is one of the very first quantum cryptography protocols, quantum protocols that was ever presented. And let me just read one part of this. An initial EPR state, one particle operations show that in a sense they allow two bits to be encoded reliably in one spin a half particle. One party Alice prepares an EPR pair, sends one of the particles to another party Bob, who applies one of four unitary operators to the particle and returns it to Alice. By measuring the two particles jointly, Alice can now reliably learn which operator Bob used. Okay, so this is also known as superdense coding. And here's a schematic of how this works. So Bob has two bits he wants to send to Alice, but he only wants to send her one photon. And normally that would not be possible using just one photon. If we're talking just about, say, the polarization of one photon, he couldn't do that. But if they share an entangled state, he can do that. How? Well, he gets one photon of that entangled state, and by doing one of four unitary transformations on that, he changes the global state. And then he sends that one photon onto Alice, and if she can tell what the total, which Bell state Bob prepared, then she can get that information. So in particular, if they start out with the state HV minus VH and Bob does nothing, then they have the state H. Obviously, they have the state HV minus VH. If he switches horizontal and vertical, then they have the state HH minus VV. If he puts a 180-degree phase shift on vertical with respect to horizontal, then the minus becomes a plus. And if he does both of these things, then they make the state HH minus VV. OK, so if Alice can detect by a single pair which of these four Bell states she has, then she gets two bits of information.
There's three photons in that problem.
There's only two photons in this problem, actually. No. There's one. One goes to Bob, and then he sends the same photon onto Alice. So there's at most two.
He operates on it. It's not the same photon.
No, it's the same photon. He's not measuring it and detecting it. He's taking it, and he's just rotating it, for example. It's really important that he's not measuring it and then resending it. That would completely kill the whole thing. So he's putting it through a wave plate. Actually, that's exactly what he's doing. He's putting it through a wave plate or a sugar solution or something like that. Correct. He knows what he did. He knows what his transformation was, but he doesn't know what the photon was. Absolutely. OK, so I'm just going to jump and say that this Bell state analysis is actually really difficult. And in fact, you can prove that it's not possible with linear optics, that you can only distinguish three of the four states with linear optics. So you're limited to a channel capacity of 1.58. It turns out, though, that if the photons are hyperentangled, then you can get all four of the states. And it's kind of a complicated setup by which we do that. And I actually don't want to spend the time on that. So, but here's how the protocol works. So we have the entangled pair. One photon goes to Bob, and then he uses some liquid crystals to implement one of these four transformations. He sends that photon back to Alice, and Alice makes measurements on the two photons that she has, and she can determine then which of the four Bell states Bob sent, and in principle then which of the two bits he was trying to send. What were the two bits he was trying to send? This is experimental data showing, depending on which state Bob was trying to encode, which state Alice actually inferred in the measurement, and she has about a 94% success probability in her current setup, and that corresponds to a channel capacity which is greater, not much greater, but greater than this log base 2 of 3, this limit that was previously in place if you don't have hyperentangled states. Okay. So, as a summary, in the relativistic quantum cryptography, if we have this extra quantum memory, then we're able to get, in principle, a yield enhancement, a better efficiency by up to a factor of 2 or 3. In practice, we've observed 1.7 and 2.6 enhancements. And as I say, the main reason I think that's interesting is the first demonstration of the, everything sounds better in German, the Überquantum advantage that you get by combining quantum mechanics and special relativity. By using hyperentanglement, the fact that the photons are born, that have this entanglement in multiple degrees of freedom, we can do a full Bell state analysis, and that allows us to do this super dense coding at this stage, 1.61 bits per photon, which is beyond this limit if you don't have hyperentangled photons. It turns out if you can access every degree of freedom, you can actually get up to about 3 bits per photon. Okay, I'm going to stop there because it's 5, and if anyone wants to ask about a lesson in quantum cooking or something, I'm happy to give that, but I feel like I have used up my time and your patience. Thank you.
Okay, if I may take the host prerogative, could you show us a couple minutes since the audience already got some questions?
Okay, so just a brief bit of background. So Bell's inequalities. How many people know Bell's inequalities? Okay, a number of you. Those of you, these are how you can prove that quantum mechanics is somehow inconsistent with local realism. The problem with Bell's inequalities is they're statistical, and there's quite a few steps, and you always kind of get the feeling, and I've done this for a long time, that maybe I kind of missed something in going from step 13 to step 14 or something like that. So a colleague of mine, Lucian Hardy, came up with an argument that doesn't rely on inequalities. And anyway, we wanted to come up with a translation of that argument into something that normal people could understand, not just people writing down sigma matrices. And so we have this quantum cakes argument. So I have a kitchen. Out of the kitchen come conveyor belts. On the conveyor belts are pairs of ovens, one going to the left, one going to the right. And we have two players who I will unfortunately slip into calling Alice and Bob, but here they're called Lucy and Ricardo for left and right. Okay, there are two types of measurements that they can make. They can wait till the ovens get all the way to the end, and when they open the oven, they find that there's a cake inside, and they can taste, does the cake taste good or not good? So that's one type of measurement, is a taste test on the cake. It either tastes good or not good. The second type of measurement they can make is they can measure in the middle, they can open the door in the middle, and they can see, has the batter of the cake risen, or has it not risen by that middle point? This is some sort of a souffle, so if they make that middle measurement, when they close the door, the cake completely collapses, and then it tastes really terrible at the end. So basically, you have a choice. You can make only one of the two measurements. You can't make both. So what we've come up with here is a semi-real-world example, though somewhat cooked, of a non-commuting observable. And it's hard to come up with classical examples of non-commuting observables. I know that rotations are non-commuting observables, but even physicists have to sit there with a book and rotate it to convince themselves that they're not commuting. So here's the point. They can only make one of these two types of measurements. They'll randomly measure on each pair of ovens that come out in one of these two ways. And now I'm just going to tell you what the results of their measurements are. Okay, so if they both measure in the middle, they find that sometimes, approximately 9% of the time, both cakes rise early. Maybe only one rises early. Maybe neither rise early, but 9% of the time, both of them rise early. Okay, if Lucy measures in the middle and Bob measures at the end, they notice that whenever her cake rose early, whenever the female measures in the middle and the male measures at the end, if her cake batter rose early, his cake always tasted good. His cake might have tasted good anyway, even if her cake didn't rise early, but whenever her cake rises early, his cake definitely tastes good, and vice versa, whenever his cake rose early, her cake tastes good. Okay, that leads us to postulate that now there's some correlation in the history of the cakes. They came from the same batter, they're made by the same chef. Clearly something, you have to have something to explain this sort of correlation. Okay, so now the last part of this is based on these three facts. What I'm telling you are three facts. The question is, if they both did the taste test, what can they predict? What will they see? What must they see based on these three facts? And none of you are allowed to leave until someone gives me an answer. And since I know I'm standing between you and dinner, and now you're thinking about having cake for dinner. Perfect. So, is that clear to everyone, right? So if 9% of the time both rise early, and whenever one rises early, the other one tastes good, it has to be that at least 9% of the time both will taste good. The problem is that, quantum mechanically, we can produce a state whereby they both never taste good simultaneously. Only one can taste good at the same time, never both simultaneously. You might wonder what that state looks like. Obviously, we can't really do this with cakes, but if we could, here's the quantum mechanical non-maximally entangled state of bad bads and bad goods. Notice there's no good-good term, so you never get both of them tasting good at the same time. We can translate this into photon polarization. If we, for example, we say good is horizontal polarization, bad is vertical, risen and not risen correspond to minus 51 and 39 degrees. Why those numbers? Those numbers are what maximize this 9% number. That's the biggest you can get is that 9%. Okay, now in practice, if we actually want to test this experimentally, which we'd like to, there's a problem because, for example, we say that something never happens. Okay, you never get a good good. But in any real experiment, you can only say something never happened to within 1 over the number of times you looked. Moreover, we don't have perfect correlations in our experiments so that whenever this rises early, this always tastes good. There's going to be a little bit of uncertainty. So if we think about when we predicted this 9%, that 9%, the number of good goods, was greater than the number of risen risens, but that's only because we never had any risen bads or bad risens. If we had some risen bads or bad risens, that would reduce the number of good goods that we would expect. Okay, I can just reorder these things, and so if I take the number of good goods, the number of bad risens, the number of risen bads, the sum of all those should be greater than the number of risen risens according to this classical logic. And experimentally, this is what we actually see. So we've got in whatever 10 seconds of data collection, 400 on one side, 2400 on the other side. Obviously, this is not greater than this. Where did our logic go awry? Well, it came from the fact that we implicitly assumed that making a measurement here doesn't affect the result of a measurement on the other side. But of course, quantum mechanics says that's not the case. When you make a measurement here, you do affect the results of something on the other side, not in a way that you can send signals faster than light, but nevertheless, there is this non-local influence. OK, so with that, I will finish with two quotes, one by Pauli and one by Victor Weisskopf. So I don't think any questions are stupid, and I invite any other questions you may have.
Okay, we have time for one or two questions, and then we'll thank the speaker again. So,
you mentioned a couple of times that you can buy these quantum encryption devices. Is there actually a real market, and if so, what are the customers?
Okay, so I'm not selling them, so I'm a little harder. It's a little harder for me to answer that. But I think one of the places they're aiming toward, for example, one limitation, it's a point-to-point protocol, right? It's not a network protocol, point-to-point. So people are thinking of going, say, for example, and also at the moment in fibers, you're limited to about 100 kilometers because you can't put a repeater in. Why can't you put a repeater in? Because a repeater is an amplifier is a cloning device. You can't clone, and so it doesn't work. So So you're limited to about 100 kilometers at the moment, or maybe 200. So people are thinking of going from a bank to the branches of the bank as one possibility. Another example, people are trying to go up to a satellite. Why up to a satellite? Well, for one thing, sometimes satellites lose their keys and you need to rekey them. I have to confess, when I first heard about that, I wasn't so excited because I don't have a satellite. But there is a protocol that's really easy to describe so that any two people who can at any time see the same satellite can distribute a quantum key. The satellite's above me, I generate a key with the satellite. Now the satellite goes above you, you generate a key with the satellite. Those are just, let's say they're each 1,000 bits long. They're just random strings of zeros and ones, so they're going to be different in about half the locations because it's just a string of zeros and ones. The satellite radios down to you, flip bit number 1, bit number 2, bit number 7, 8, bit number 11, roughly half of them. And you flip those, and then you have the same key that I do. An eavesdropper can hear the satellite saying, flip bit number 3. She didn't know what it was to begin with. She doesn't know what it is afterwards, so that doesn't ruin the security of the system. You have to trust the satellite in that case. Turns out if you do this with entangled photons, you don't even have to trust the satellite. Your satellite can be owned by the eavesdropper. So that's banks, maybe military sort of applications.
Okay, how about one more? Okay, well, let's thank Paul again.
Thank you.
Thank you.